You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 19.
I'm Jessica, and I'll be your host today for this panel episode on publishing. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge the Nooch, or Ute peoples, on whose traditional homeland I am recording today, as well as the other tribes with ancestral connections to this land. So Lyle was supposed to be here on this podcast as a panelist today, but we were having some technical difficulties, so that might not happen. Hopefully we can still get him on here, though, because he's quite impressive with his publications, and I'm sure he'd have a lot to say. Actually, the timing on this is kind of funny because Archaeology Southwest just launched their most recent magazine on Bears Ears National Monument, titled Sacred and Threatened, and Lyle, Dr. Kathleen Van Vlack on today's panel, and I are all in there. And Lyle wrote about Hopi connections to the area, and Kathleen and I wrote about the ethnographic project that we've been working on with the Utah BLM Monticello Field Office. So big thanks to the Utah BLM, the tribes that we've been working with, and Archaeology Southwest. Check it out. It's a stunning issue, as per their usual. And it features a good number of incredible Indigenous authors who we've been lucky enough to work with. Also, final thing, and then I swear we'll jump in. If you have learned something or benefited in some way from this podcast and the incredible guests that we've interviewed, please consider becoming a member of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Putting together these episodes and maintaining the network is actually pretty expensive, even with all of our volunteer labor. So if you can please help us be able to continue to offer this resource, and in return, you'll get some pretty sweet swag and extras. And big thanks, of course, to all of our members. You guys are amazing. Okay, Dr. Hardy, would you mind starting us out on introductions for the panel?
Sure. I am Lisa Hardy, and I am a professor at Northern Arizona University. And I specialize in medical anthropology and community engaged research and practice, and recently took on the editor position with the journal Practicing Anthropology, which is one of the two journals that come out of the Society for Applied Anthropology.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Van Vlack. I am an applied anthropologist, and I work with you, Jessica, at Living Heritage Anthropology. I'm also an adjunct professor at Westchester Community College here in New York. And as one of the things that I do, we're working with Jessica, I work a lot with Native Americans on cultural resource issues, sacred sites protections, and cultural landscapes. And I am also the past president of the High Plains Society of Applied Anthropology, and I'm the current editor of their journal, The Applied Anthropologist.
So just to clarify there, when Kathleen says that she's working in cultural resources, she means she's working in cultural resources and heritage like the way I am. So she's also an ethnographer, so we're both CRM ethnographers, not archaeologists.
I'm David Martinez. I'm an associate professor of American Indian Studies at Arizona State University. In addition, I'm Akimal Azam, enrolled in the Gila River Indian Community here in Arizona. And my area of concentration is American Indian intellectual history, art and art history, and Azam studies.
I'm Sarah Herr, and I'm the archaeologist on this show. And I'm president of Desert Archaeology, a cultural resource management firm in Tucson, Arizona. And for about the past 18 months, I'm one of the editors of the Society for American Archaeology's journal, Advances in Archaeological Practice. I do that with the State Archaeologist of New York, Christina Reich, and with an archaeologist in Amsterdam, Sjord Vanderlund, as well. We have a digital reviews editor named Sarah Perry out of London.
Okay, so to start us out, could you all talk about some of your experiences with publishing and also what you learned from those experiences? And then second, could you talk a little bit about the topics that you've all published on so far?
So right after grad school, I tried to write up some of my dissertation research and make it into journal articles and sent it around, and it just really never never led to anything. And I realized pretty quickly that I wasn't going about it in the right way. And I also realized after a few more years that the only time I really wanted to publish was when I wanted to publish something that I thought could be useful to others, and not just publishing to say something that I found in my dissertation. And so since then, most of my publications are collaborative work that makes some kind of implication for policy. Or, for example, I have several articles that are best practices for community-engaged research, or the call for further impact on the connection between immigration policy and public health, things that I feel like contribute to different projects where people are trying to do collaborative work. So that's where most of my publications are.
Oh, geez. Well, I've been at this game for a while. It feels like forever, actually. My first publication actually was a book review. And it was advised to me in graduate school that the best way to get, if you're an up and coming, you're a grad student, you want to get something published, book and fairly relatively quickly and get a free book. I think graduate students always like are free books, right? It's to go after book reviews. So my first one was actually was a review on a book written by a youth person, and it was about one of their family members. Rather interesting book. The name escapes me at the moment, and I can get it to you later, Jessica, if you want to include it with the podcast notes, so forgive me. But then after that, I was fortunate enough to work on a research team that really emphasized collaborative writing, getting everybody involved in the publications, from all levels, from PhDs right down to the undergrads. And so and I was included in the production of a couple articles. It was based off of research that we were doing at the time, but also served a bigger purpose to speak towards policy or towards a theoretical issue that was important to help understand, explain some cultural issues we were dealing with in regarding the project. But then as I moved towards, trying to publish my own work, I found it is a process and kind of difficult. Being from the numerous rejection letters to dealing with cranky reviewers to people even challenging whether my data was valid. So I've ran the gamut of things being accepted really fast, especially with the previous professors who already had clout in the field, but trying to publish my own stuff as an up-and-coming scholar, and I hit some roadblocks along the way. But one of the things that was always taught to me and emphasized was pushing for collaborative research. Make sure, your work can speak to something useful and important, and that it will help, move move the boundary of knowledge in a direction to make sure that people can read it, hopefully learn from it and take something away from it that they didn't know before.
Yeah. My career in publishing began when I was an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. I started there back in 2000. More specifically, I began my career as an AIS professor after having earned my PhD in philosophy from Stony Brook. So I was actually transitioning from one scholarly field into another. I'd always been focused on Native traditions. Nonetheless, the academic environment between philosophy and American Indian studies was pretty dramatic. So what I began doing at that point with respect to publishing is, well, for starters, I started identifying journals such as the American Indian Quarterly or the Chajasha Review and the people associated with those journals, as possible sources for publishing my work. Because of the relationship I had with the Native communities and the Twin Cities, I started realizing that one thing that the Native community needed was actually work in intellectual history. We needed somebody to document, you know, the development of our ideas regarding sovereignty, self-determination, peoplehood, and develop the discourse, you know, that we've created as sovereign indigenous people, and get that work published in venues that will reach the community that needed to see these things the most. And so I would, in addition to identifying journals, you know, I would go to conferences and meet my peers in the American Indian Studies world, you know, get to know their work and the process, and start figuring out what it is that I can contribute, you know, to my communities. So that there was a bridge that would be built between the Native communities on the reservation and urban areas and the academic community that I served. And so my first book was on Charles Eastman, the Dakota activist and writer in the early 20th century. And I developed that project because I had developed a meaningful relationship with the Dakota community in southern Minnesota. And so that became kind of the foundation, the paradigm, if you will, for how I developed my research projects. They were informed by what was going on in my field, but also how I proceeded to develop my analyses was based on the countless conversations that I had with the tribal elders, you know, my students, you know, my peers. In other words, I tried to make sure that I was in touch with the community folks whenever I embarked on a new project. And that's informed my scholarly life to this day, including the recent project that is in production now at the University of Nebraska. I just did an intellectual biography of the Standing Rock Sioux activist intellectual Von Delaria Jr., which is coming out next spring.
Hi, there's quite a bibliography being accumulated on this conversation already. Many things I want to read. Let's see, I've been publishing, I guess, for over 25 years. I started as a graduate student, and much of the work is, you know, largely technical from an archaeological point of view. I don't write very quickly. It takes me a while to kind of internalize the significance of the projects I've worked on. For peer-reviewed articles, it's a bit slower for me. I don't put out a lot, but I published in some edited books. My dissertation turned into a monograph that, in the end, after it being well edited, I was pleased with. And then a few journal articles, and I try and target the journal articles to the audiences that I think will be most interested in reading them. So I guess that's my topics have often been research topics. My pragmatism is that I'm not interested in publishing in necessarily the most prestigious journal. I want it to be read by the people who are practitioners and who might be able to build on my research, question my research, and improve it. That's probably a fair enough summary of what I've done. I guess my work is largely in Arizona, and largely in central Arizona, on Western Apache and ancestral Puebloan landscapes.
Okay. So one thing that you all touched on somewhat, but Dr. Martinez specifically was touching on it a lot, is making sure that the people that we are working with are also benefiting from what we publish. And that's something that Sean talked about a couple of episodes ago, where he used videos and plays as examples of ways to include the community you work with in outreach. So I guess my question is, first, is peer reviewed publishing even relevant anymore? And second, how do you balance peer reviewed publishing with publishing or other types of outreach that's focused on either a general audience or the community that you're working with specifically?
I can jump in if that's okay. I'm a big believer in both publishing for an academic audience and also for a non-academic, so like for public consumption audience, especially if you want to educate them on an issue. You mentioned Bears Ears and the Archaeology Southwest publication, Jessica. It's a beautiful, beautiful publication, and I think it's something that if a layperson, like non-anthropology person, was to pick that up and read it, they could really get a sense of how important that area is. And there's other venues out there too that publish anthropologists and their work. I mean, Margaret Mead being one of the most famous ones when she published in Red Book, you know. And it's one thing if we're talking in academic circles, you know, but it's kind of like we're talking amongst ourselves. And if we want to use our work to create change in some level, we need to make sure we get it out there for public consumption. So Sean doing his videography work, for example, is great because that can be used in all kinds of formats. But also we have a, so I think, you know, finding those non-academic, non-traditional academic publishing sources is great, you know, especially and for things that are hotly contested, such as Bears Ears right now, as we know. It's all over the news, but, you know, we got to educate the people of what's going on out there, especially like people back east, for example, who barely know where Utah is, or know that Utah exists, but don't know where exactly Bears Ears is located and why it's so important.
It's funny coming from the person currently living in New York.
Right, exactly. That's what I thought about it, because I say I work in, you know, working out in the Cedar Mesa, Bears Ears area, people are like, where's that? So it becomes a, you know, you got to educate people on geography a little bit. And I say that with love for my people in New York. But, but also it's important to us too as academics to publish for our peers. You know, this is where ideas get shared. Theory, you know, new ideas get born and new research questions come out of, you know, and that's what keeps us going as researchers, as academics, you know, is talking amongst our peers and sharing that knowledge with them. And it also leads to collaboration too. You know, I could have an idea and publish about a research question, but then somebody could read my article and contact me and say, hey, you want to collaborate on something similar? Because I was thinking about the same thing, but from a slightly different approach. Why don't we team up? You know, there's the idea sharing. So I think we have a responsibility in terms of publishing to try to balance both, you know, for the masses and then for our academic peers.
And I certainly agree. I think one of the challenges today is that there's, I mean, now that we're in the information age, there's so much information out there. There's a lot about archaeology, and there's a whole spectrum of authority in what's said. And so I very much value publications that are peer reviewed in the hopes that they are providing, you know, a somewhat, you know, that's providing a high standard. And while I really am enjoying, our company does a blog, and, you know, I really enjoy reading blogs, those aren't necessarily evaluated. And so I like publication because it helps separate, like, here's some research that's fairly solid. It might be intellectually challenged. But it's moving, it's, you know, moving incrementally forward, and then having the whole spectrum of other conversations about it that may, you know, be more speculative and, you know, engaging and things like that. But we need to have, we need to have both the kind of excitement, engagement of the public and the, non-censored stuff, but it needs to be balanced, because it's easy to go off on kind of a tangent. And as we've all seen, things can go very far off of where truth lies. And so it's kind of one of the interesting challenges right now where it's easy to get online publications, digital publications, peer-reviewed or not, and blogs. And I'm not sure everybody who's a reader recognizes that continuum. So I think it's an interesting time and balance between how we communicate.
On that note, we're going to take our first break. First, real quick, though, Kathleen sent me a message that the book review that she was referring to was for a book called Ordeal of Change, Southern Utes and Their Neighbors by Francis Leon Quintana. And a link will be included to that in the show notes. All right, well, we'll be right back.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high quality downloads of each show and a discount at our online store, and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Okay, and we are back. So, okay, we were just talking about academic publishing versus publishing for a more general audience. And we heard from a couple of you. Did any of you, David or Lisa, have anything that you wanted to add to that topic?
I agree with what's already been said. And I would just say that I think the best thing right now is to be really fluent in different media. So I do definitely agree that there's still a good place for a peer reviewed publication. And also what I like to do and what I like to talk with my students about is disseminating our research in different ways. And so what that means is if you're working with a community group and you want to do a peer reviewed research article because you think there's something to be said that will be going out to that audience, that you also do a community report or a policy brief or something that can get back to your community partners quickly, because the peer review process takes a really long time. And the other thing that I've been thinking a lot about with editing practicing anthropology is that we're opening it up. We just opened up a section for creative work, because I don't know about you, but for me, when I think about what has inspired me in my life, a lot of it has been creative. And I think a lot of the anthropologists are really creative, whether or not they make space for that in their academic work. So a lot of the anthropologists who are poets and artists and write fiction. And so what we're going to start to do is accept submissions, and we already have some that are really interesting, of people creating something, maybe first-person voice that relates to their work in anthropology that is expressed in a creative way. And this also is going to include, we started a blog, so we will include video clips and Tumblr posts and things like that that will allow us to expand the media in which people can use to express the importance of their work.
Well, I suppose the dilemma that we face in American Indian Studies, myself included, is the dilemma that all academics face, which is, how do we connect our research and our scholarly publications and discussions, you know, with a wider audience, or are we just all talking to each other? And in the case of my field, there's a genuine concern for recruiting as many young Native scholars as we can into academia to become professors, to become part of the academy. And so, you know, we do try to advise our students on the importance of developing a research agenda, one that's based on the community values and issues, but can shape the discourse that's going on in the scholarly fields that are pertinent to American Indian communities. And so, you know, we try to bridge the gap between community and publishing so that what they publish is relevant to their communities, you know, from the onset. That way, when they become published and they become distinguished, they're establishing themselves as Native scholars, you know, as authorities that their communities can turn to for expertise and advice. And so I think it's important when it comes to the question of how do you make your research and publishing relevant, or even relevant to begin with, is to start with those essential questions. Well, what is it that your community, the one that you want to serve, you know, actually needs? And can you contribute something, you know, as a researcher and a thinker, you know, that to those issues and to those topics? And then when you can say yes and develop the work that's needed, you know, it does have an impact, you know, at all levels of Native society. But there's a lot of work that is done as an Indian itself, and, you know, maybe it follows certain intellectual trends, theoretical trends, and maybe only a small portion of people will ever read that work. But that's okay. You know, as long as, I think as long as you're reaching as many audiences as you can, you know, particularly as a Native person, you know, you can make some difference at some level. So that's what I tell my students.
otherwise you know it is easy to get. And I'm kind of skeptical, maybe even a little cynical about the whole process, because you know, obviously it does. Writing takes a long time, you know, to develop the work, to refine the work, to get it published, to go through peer review, revision. It's a lengthy, time-consuming process. It takes a lot of patience, and you know, you don't always see an immediate return on the work that you produce, and that's what I try to alert my students to, you know, as well, that your work can have an impact, but it could take quite some time.
Yeah, one of the things I looked at once when I was evaluating the journals that I've worked with, because I've worked with both this Advances in Archaeological Practice, but also with Kiva, which is a regional archaeological and anthropological journal, and we looked at how long it took for articles to get read. And I think the span and lifespan of an article is often 5 to 10 years. So in terms of encouraging students to know that it's not an immediate return on their scholarship, it does have a 10-year, you know, probably duration and currency, at least in our fields, I think.
That's interesting. It's good to like have some numbers attached to that.
Yeah, because you know, you look at, you know, these days you can look at your article being published online, and you can look at, you know, all these various metrics that they put up online, and you can be kind of glum. You're like, oh my God, only 200 people clicked on my abstract, but know that in, you know, 8 to 10 years there will be far, far more people who have it. It just seems to spread more slowly than the physics does. So.
Right. Right. Okay. So both of you touched a little bit there on some of the challenges with peer-reviewed journals as opposed to more general consumption, like you mentioned your blog and podcasts, for one. So one thing that I sent an article to those of you that are on the panel, and we'll link it in the show notes for those of you that are listening. But The article is called The Politics of Citation is the Peer Review Process Biased Against Indigenous Academics. And one of the things that they talk about in this article, and it looks like there's a link to listen to, is that a lot of journals and peer review people that are doing peer reviews want to see people that are preeminent in the field or have been in the past, which is a lot of, you know, old white men, in these journal articles, even if it's not necessarily the best place for those specific citations. So, I'd be interested to hear from all of you about where you think some of the challenges are with the peer review process and how you think it could be made better in the future, especially for, you know, Indigenous scholars and other disenfranchised groups.
This is Lisa. I've been thinking about this since you sent that article, and I really like that's being raised. I do agree with that, and I think that sometimes going through the peer review process, for example, doing community-based or just peer research, reviewers sometimes don't understand what that is, and like they don't read it necessarily in a way that allows for a good peer review. Or I also at one point tried to publish a piece where a research participant gave this beautiful interview, and I went back to the IRB and I got IRB approval for that person to author their own words, and they would, that person then had editorial control over the transcript of their interview. And this person was an American Indian healthcare provider, and no journal that I got in contact with, and I was looking at public health journals and some other journals, wanted to publish this article because it wasn't the typical article. It was written by a community member and not by a researcher. So I think that we really have a long way to go to open it up to different types of article formats, and also to assign people in editorial positions and reviewer positions who are American Indian and of other ethnicities. One of the things that I hope to do is to have guest-edited issues where, you know, I am white, I'm a white woman, and when you look at some of the editorial boards on these journals, it looks like a lot of white people. And so because of that, I hope to have issues that are guest edited and then pushed when my term is up in 3 years for an editor who is a person of color and who is not reflecting the same sort of article bias or structure that we might see from a whole bunch of voices that are in similar places on editorial boards and as peer reviewers.
I think that raises a very good point. My experience in publishing, my interaction with reviewers and editorial boards, the majority of them have been the old guard in academia, which is white males, a lot of them. And they get very protective of the knowledge they let into their spaces. I think what needs to happen, and I was speaking as a white woman with a PhD here. I mean, obviously others could agree or disagree or add to it, but definitely diversify the people who are reviewing the articles, the editorships of journals. You know, I just expand who's involved. Like, get the younger guard involved in academic publishing and journals. I have to plug my own journal, but I'm at High Plains. We have been very active to involve the younger members of the society in all forms of leadership, whether it be in the journal or in publication or serving on the board, just so that we can spread out and stop it being just one person's voice or one group of people's voice that dominates the conversation and try to expand and bring some of the disenfranchised or ignored voices to the forefront, because that's how it should be. It shouldn't just be one group of people talking and be considered the experts in the field when they're not, when there's other more qualified people that just because they don't have the academic credentials as, say, some older person with a PhD, that they get shut out. And I was looking at the article that you sent out, Jessica, and it speaks a lot about some of the biases that I've seen in the field. I've seen in my own attempts to publish. There's not only just, I think that there's biases that exist against people of color, against indigenous peoples, but there's also sexism at play too. And that's a big problem that we need to change in academia. It speaks to a bigger issue that's at play, I think. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was funny on Twitter I wish I remembered who it was. Maybe Sarah, maybe you remember. But they just announced the new upcoming editor for the Society for Historical Archaeology's journal. And she was going to be the first woman editor of this journal.
That's crazy. Especially if you look at the ratio of students who are in college right now or going to grad school, women dominate the field, in anthropology, right. And they should be the ones, you should see more women as professors. You should see more women out there publishing and being in charge of journals, and not to mention having more, of non-white people in charge, they bring a lot to the table too. It shouldn't just be this status quo that it's been for the past 100 years. It's not right.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing, I don't know how much it affects, folks' choice of where they want to publish, but I mean, one thing that we might want to think about is, I don't know how your journals work, but ours has a double blind peer review process. And so the authors aren't known. Sometimes when I receive manuscripts for my own evaluation, not as an editor, just, as a peer reviewer, authors' names are on there, and that sort of predispositions you for a certain kind of review because whether they're your seniors, your juniors, where they're positioned. So our journal just sends them out double blind, so the peer reviewers don't know who they're evaluating. And I've found it's an interesting process, and hopefully that there's some, I think, writing that becomes more fair. It is interesting to see in the reviews that I get back from peer reviewers that they often try and guess who the authors are. They can't help but guessing. And so sometimes I will see people guessing that they think this is a junior scholar, for example, and they'll start writing in a tone that talks down to them, as if they're a professor to a graduate student, for example. But just in terms of the diversification, and making people think more inclusively, I think that may be a tool that I would like to think will help even out the playing field. But that said, I also think that sometimes, you know, some of the folks from, you know, more diverse backgrounds maybe haven't had as much experience publishing to begin with. And so they may have other challenges as they enter into the publishing world that, you know, that kind of peer review won't solve. And there's other ways that we as editors can help them out.
Mm-hmm. And have you come to any thoughts on what that might look like? On how to help them out?
Well, mm-hmm. I guess... I mean, I'll be interested to hear from the rest of folks, because I don't work with probably Indigenous authors as regularly, but I do, you know, with other kinds of diversity. I guess, you know, some of the things I would say that to people who are entry level authors is that they should just not be shy about getting a hold of the editors, start talking through their paper and how it fits with the journal, even when it's still in the conceptual stage, because there's certain amounts of information that we can share with them. That can help them peg their article for greater success. We can also talk to them about their concerns. For example, I had a young author. She's not Indigenous. She's just a young author, but who was very worried about her perception of how some of her early articles had been reviewed, and they'd been very aggressively reviewed by more senior people. And I said, okay, well, I know that about you now. And so, you know, as your editor, I will be particularly sensitive to triaging the peer reviews that I get. And make sure that I think that you're absolutely getting a fair review. And I'll tell you what I think as well. So if somebody's being too harsh on you. So there's different ways we can take a little bit more of a mentorship approach. We don't have to take fully a gatekeeper approach, you know, which is another role of the editor, is to be a gatekeeper, but we can also be mentors to folks that I guess they have to approach us though, and they have to be bold enough to approach us and ask for that help. I guess that would be one comment, but I would certainly be curious about the other folks. How they engage.
Right. And that's one of the reasons, one of the main reasons why Lyle and I wanted to do this podcast was actually you did a webinar on publishing within your journal. And I really just loved the way it seemed like it would make people feel a lot more comfortable. Like they could approach you, like, publishing wasn't so scary. And so that was part of what I was hoping we would do with this podcast was having people listen who maybe haven't published before. Maybe they might come out feeling inspired, like, hey, I could reach out to that journal editor. They sounded really nice. And, you know, maybe this isn't quite as intimidating as I thought. So I hope that comes across to everybody listening. And we are actually at our second break point, but we're getting into really interesting stuff. So I'm excited to come back and keep talking about all of this after the break.
The Archaeology Podcast Network has partnered with Tee Public to bring you some awesome gear that looks good, promotes archaeology, and puts a few pennies in our pockets so you can get free podcasts. Check out our designs at arcpodnet.com/shop. That's arcpodnet.com/shop.
All right. And we are back. So... really loving this conversation that we're having. Does anybody have anything more that they want to add to everything that we were just talking about?
Yeah, this is Lisa. I have a couple of quick things. I think that one of them is I like to see journals that are adding different types of articles so that, for example, if you have a community partner that you're working with, that person could author their own piece. And there are some journals that are doing that, like Progress and Community Health Partnerships, and they ask people to write also something in lay language that people could read who aren't an academic audience. And I think that structurally, that's going to help open up the ability for people to publish who might not be coming from a traditional academic background, but have something really important to contribute. And the other thing, I really like this idea that we were just talking about mentoring new authors. And I can't really even say enough about how important it is when people are trying to publish something to not get stuck by your internal voices of, you know, this isn't good enough, or I don't know how to write this, or nobody would want to read this, or a million people are writing already. Why would anyone want to read my stuff? And I think that we all struggle with that. I was struck the other day because I was talking to a senior person who's already retired and has many, many, many publications. And she said to me, I still fear the blank page. And when I sit down at my computer and I'm looking at a blank document, I get very upset and uncomfortable and I don't know where to start. And I thought that was interesting coming from someone at past retirement age who's been publishing for years. So I like the idea of editors in a mentorship role. And I also, just for anyone who's listening, who's afraid of getting their stuff out there, even if you get a bad review, you know, there's this joke about reviewer two who's always a jerk. If you get a bad review, just pick your stuff back up and edit it and keep submitting and keep reaching out to editors, because we don't want to get stuck in a place of thinking that, you know, we can't write or our stuff isn't good, because I think anyone can keep working and find mentors and collaborators and figure out, if you really have something to say, how to get it published.
Well, David, I'd be really interested on your perspective coming from American Indian Studies on how you think that, have you heard of any particular challenges with publishing from among your peers that maybe people in other parts of academia don't, haven't experienced or wouldn't realize would be an issue for people? And obviously, Kathleen, you got your PhD in American Indian Studies as well. So maybe you could speak to this some too, but just basically, if there's specific types of challenges that Indigenous people face with publishing compared to maybe just your average white academic in anthropology, let's say.
Yeah. When it comes to bias in getting, you know, Native scholarship, you know, published in peer-reviewed journals, it does happen, but it doesn't happen in every case. I think it depends on, in large part, the field that one wants to publish in. For example, if a Native scholar wants to publish in the field of, say, history, I think that the field of American Indian history is developed enough where, you know, scholarship in those journals, you know, it is an easier process than, say, fields where there's very, very few Native scholars involved, either as writers or as editors. I experienced the latter when I was trying to get my work published in philosophy journals a long time ago. But the bias that I encountered was really just one in which the people reading my work didn't understand what I was trying to do. And it didn't meet their expectations that, you know, I was supposed to be citing certain sources in Western philosophy. Why was I talking about this Native stuff? And so there was a lot of rejection involved. And so when it comes to the phenomenon of bias, you know, it's definitely there, but it's not necessarily malicious or systemic. A lot of times it's just ignorance. And so when it comes to trying to break new ground in scholarly fields where there's not a lot of Native scholarship, one thing that I attempt to caution junior faculty about is that when you attempt to publish in those fields, you're going to have to deal with a lot of rejection, a lot of misunderstanding, but it's often the price you have to pay in order to make a difference in that field. And so I suppose one way, you know, as a Native scholar, you know, that I recommend for handling situations is to, well, for one thing, you know, get to know your audience. If you're going to publish in journals where there's not a lot of Natives, you know, get to know that audience so that what you're sending to them is more agreeable to what their expectations are. Not that you have to sacrifice your indigeneity in the process, but you have to be more aware of your scholarly environment. At the same time, you know, find an amenable audience in Native-run journals, you know, so that you can reach that audience as well, and it'll develop your work within a more intellectually friendly environment, and we get the pointed feedback from native scholars. You know, that can help you build not only confidence but also your reputation. And once you do that, it will make it more possible to get published in these other journals that you want to break into. Also, as I was thinking about the question, one thing that came to mind, and this is kind of personal experience, is the issue of bias needs to be handled when the scholar in question is still a student, especially if they're a person of color, such as a native student. What I'm getting at is a lot of us, when we were college students, and you know, we were showing our papers to our professors or our non-native professors, you know, we got a lot of encouragement. And that encouragement included, you know, being told that, you know, the field that we're writing in, you know, in my case, philosophy, was just waiting to hear from me. You know, that if I would just get my work out there, it would make a huge difference. And so the point I'm trying to make is you have to alert, you know, your young people, your students, to the fact that they may have a major contribution that should be read and seen, but at the same time, they have to know that there is institutional bias out there that may not understand what it is that they're trying to do. And so it took one of my mentors when I was a young guy, you know, to say to me, he was one of my biggest fans, to say to me, this was in philosophy, you know, do you really expect, you know, people in this field to want to read Von Deloria? And just being alerted to that bias was eye-opening, because I had developed this mythology that all I needed to do was show the world my work and it would get published left and right, when it's a little more complicated than that. And so, yeah, bias definitely exists, but it's not necessarily, you know, the career-ending obstacle that you might think it is. And so, I don't know if that's a clear answer, but it's an honest one.
I guess as you talk, it reminds me that, you know, when I talk to other folks who are entering into the academy, and since I'm not there, I hear them talk about their very strategic ways that they behave in their ways of that they want to get a job, the people that they network with. And I think publishing also is similarly a strategic action. And so while you would like to think that your voice is free, and you know, you can just say what you want, there's a lot of structure in how is structure and expectation in how articles are presented in journals. I mean, I like that. I think it's Lisa who's opening this up quite a bit, but I think about publication and the way you write as one more piece of that strategy for your career. And so know that maybe there's a certain structure to how you write and how you present your arguments, and you can still get your stuff in there, but knowing that there's a little bit of scaffolding around it.
Does anyone else have any additional advice that they would add for people that are new to publishing?
Yeah, just try not to get discouraged with the rejection letters. It's part of the process. I was once told that there was a time when the American Anthropologists, for example, rejected over 90% of their submissions right off the bat. And Human Organization had a high rejection rate, too. It's probably still the same way. I haven't submitted to Human Organization in a long time. But when I did, I was rejected. I mean, it's part of the process. The things that you hope for is when you get rejected is that you get good feedback from your reviewers. A couple of cases, I got really good feedback from reviewers, and it made my manuscript stronger, and I eventually got it published. You know, it takes a while too. It's not a hurry up, you know, in about a month turnaround time, you'll get something back and you'll be published. It can take up to 2 years. It can take a while. So you just got to have patience and be prepared for, you know, to maybe not get it accepted the first go around, and, you know, take whatever criticisms, whether they're positive or negative, that they give you, and try to turn it into something where as a learning moment, and you can make the manuscript stronger in areas it might've been, you didn't realize it was deficient in, until somebody else on the outside who doesn't know your topic as well as you do, they read it and they found a point of weakness, and then you strengthen your argument, you know, and that can help you. One, it helps you as a scholar, it helps you as a writer to keep improving. And even though it stinks when you get rejected, and you put so much into writing a manuscript, you know, you spend sometimes, you know, months or even, you know, a year's time or more working on this piece, and you think it's so good when you submit it, and then you get turned down, and it can be kind of soul crushing. But you just gotta, the thing that I learned is that you just gotta pick yourself back up. You know, don't grieve too much for the rejection letter, but go back at it. And somebody out there will want your manuscript, will want to publish it in their journal. It's all about finding that appropriate voice, that appropriate place to put it out there for. You know, maybe it's not good enough for, it's not something that human organization wants per se, but say the Journal of Intangible Heritage wants it, and you submit it to them and they accept it. And then you're in a well-known, respected mm-hmm. journal in heritage studies. You know, it's just trying to find that right audience and that right balance, and just don't get discouraged and don't give up. Just hang in there. It will work out.
That reminds me of a thing I heard in, it was for business, for, you know, it was like business advice basically, but someone said to set a goal of how many no's that you want to receive per month, not necessarily related to publishing, but related to anything. And if you're not hitting your number of people saying no to you, then you're not putting yourself out there enough. Thought that was kind of an interesting way of turning something that can feel really negative into something that's kind of positive.
This is Lisa. And I was thinking about, there's something called Duotrope, which is an online submission kind of system, but it's for creative work, not academic work. And you subscribe to it. I think it's like $5 a month, and you can keep track of where you've submitted creative work. But one of the things on there that I would like to see academic journals do eventually is that they have metrics where you can go and look at the rejections and the acceptances that have happened every day. They update it every 5 minutes. And when you scroll through it, you see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rejections, and then one acceptance, and then hundreds of rejections, and then one acceptance. And looking at that, for me, I like to show them that. I like to look at it because I think if you could see those metrics, you feel like, oh, everyone else out there is getting, their articles are getting accepted. And what you don't realize is that every single person who's published has had many rejections on the way to getting published. It's an exception to the rule that somebody would be accepted the first submission, or, you know, someone who has 20 articles might get multiple rejections on the 21st article that they try to submit. So I think it's good to keep that in perspective. And then the other thing I wanted to say too is that I like this idea of scaffolding around publishing. I think that as first-time authors, sometimes people write up their stuff and then they go and find a place to put it. And that's not always the most successful way to do it. I think it's successful to look at different journals and really look at the instructions for articles, the instructions for authors, what type of articles, length first, and then write your ideas into that kind of structure of the different journals if you can, which may seem like it reduces creativity, but I don't think it does once you kind of get fluent at looking at different journals. Because what happens is, what if you're rejected from one journal, you're going to quickly turn it around, ideally into a submission for another journal that might have a different type of article. But being able to be aware of what that structure is as you write or before you write, I think is a helpful process for anyone, and especially for new people who are newly trying to publish their work.
Yeah, actually, and at least for archaeologists, and I don't know if this goes for you as cultural anthropologists, it's often a good idea when you have your project to do exactly what you said, to build to build your articles. So it's often really good to get your data article out first, because then you've established like a threshold, basically. And then, you know, then you get your kind of maybe your more creative theory articles out there. And so there's a sequence to that. And so maybe that like the data article is easier to publish. It's more in a regional journal than a national or international journal. But you're absolutely right. Thinking about your strategy and your scaffolding can be a really good process and also help you train yourself to write.
So I guess to close out, what I want to do is, if you guys wouldn't mind, so the three of you as editors, and then I'll ask you to do a little bit something different, but the three of you that are editors, would you mind just really briefly explaining what the focus of your journal is? So like what kind of articles do you have, things like that? What you would like to see, like what kind of articles you'd like to see in your journal, and what kind of authors would you like to have, or what are you trying to target? Where would you like to go? I know that's a lot real quick, but, and then David, if you want to talk about the American Indian Studies program at ASU and kind of the similar thing, like what's the focus of your program? Where would you like to take it? And what kind of students would you like to have? I mean, you know, I'm an Arizona Wildcat, you know, but
same here, right. I don't know about you too.
But I guess we could have you talk about ASU. So I guess, Lisa, would you like to start?
Sure. So practicing anthropology as opposed to human organization, which is the other Society for Anthropology, Applied Anthropology publication, is looking for shorter articles, fewer citations, written for a broad audience about people practicing anthropology in the field. So it's a little bit less intimidating than writing a super long, heavily cited, theory-based article. I think that's at least the goal. For me, as thinking about where I'd like to see it go, I really want to see people writing things in first person, looking at some of other publications and also abstracts for some of the conferences. I still see a lot of work that almost sounds like colonial endeavors, settler colonialism, someone writing about someone else's cultural tradition. And what I'd like to see is a lot of work of people writing about their own communities or their own reflections on practice in the field that can help other practicing anthropologists rather than that kind of old school settler colonial view. I also want to see a focus on social justice, social movements, and highlighting and centering the voices of people of color and historically underrepresented authors. And then, like I said, we have this sort of creative piece submission process that we've opened. So we're doing that. Also, one more thing, we will have some special issue calls coming out. So on the SFAA Facebook page, we're going to be putting flyers up there when we have special issues. So people can keep an eye on that and submit if they find one that they're interested in.
Great. Sarah?
So as I said, ours is Advances in Archaeological Practice and is a journal for the Society for American Archaeology. So when we put together our editorial team for this journal, we were trying to make a point about diversity in the profession, although not necessarily ethnic diversity, but just kind of diversity in all ways in practice. And so our team doesn't include any academics on it. So I work in the private sector. My co-editor is a government archaeologist, and we have another archaeologist who works for nonprofit in Europe. So we were definitely going for diversity, and all of us feel like archaeology is the starting point for conversations, but it isn't the be-all and end-all. It's kind of how you take archaeology into other conversations about the sciences and other conversations about being human and more humanities approaches, more collaborative approaches as well. And so we're trying to encourage like all that kinds of engagement. So both interdisciplinary articles and collaborative articles, I think, are probably the two directions that we like. And it's quite a mix in the journal. We take three kinds of articles. One of them is a research article, but it's still about method or practice. If somebody writes about theory, we reject them right off the bat.
it's awkward to write a letter being like, you're too theoretical, I'm sorry, I'm going to reject you. We also take how-to articles, so super pragmatic. And then we're just on the verge of starting a new type of article that we hope to have out sometime in 2018, which is an interview. And that will be peer reviewed, but it's meant to get more inclusive voices in there so that if we want a type of person who's uncomfortable writing, we'll have somebody who is comfortable writing interview them and try and get more opinions and critical thinking into the journal. We think people are a little cautious when they're peer reviewed. We think that maybe if they're interviewed, they'll tell us what they're really thinking. And we might actually start with some retirees, so there's no consequences if they tell us what they're really thinking.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
We also have an article type that's called digital reviews that looks at things like blogs and online and all kinds of online and digital technologies and provides a review of that. So in contrast to book reviews, we're doing digital reviews, and we have our editor in London takes emails from folks to gauge their interest.
So like podcasts?
So podcasts, actually we have one that should be awesome. Coming out on podcasts. Yes. And another one that just came out on, what is it called? Museum extensions to websites. So when a museum puts up, a little extra thing, what happens to it when the museum exhibit is taken down?
Very
so
cool.
Things like that.
So Kathleen.
Okay. So before I get into what the Applied Anthropologist is, I just want to give a background of the High Plains Society for Applied Anthropology. It was founded by Omer Stewart back in the early 80s, late 70s, and it is a local practitioner organization. So it's a smaller regional group of the main society, which is Society for Applied Anthropology. And we're a group about 120 maybe around 200 people strong. We meet twice a year. We have a wonderful fall retreat, Ghost Ranch in New Mexico. We have an annual meeting in Colorado. But we are probably outside of like the Washington Applied Anthropology Organization, Washington, D.C., we're probably the second biggest group of local practitioner organizations. And we also have our own journal. It used to be the High Plains Applied Anthropologist, but we decided, because we were getting stuck in a rut, people thinking we were only focused on the High Plains and Native American issues, we decided to change our name back in 2005 to the Applied Anthropologist. It reflects more of our membership. We're very diversified in what we do in terms of a group. We got people working all over the world on different issues, from cultural resource management to social justice to environmental work. So we thought we'd pick a title that reflected who we were. And so for some reason, they decided I would make a good editor when they needed a new editorship. That position came out open, and they thought, well, we'll pick her. I don't know what they were thinking, but they did. But our journal, what we do is we publish anything from research articles to shorter pieces describing research projects. We do book reviews. We're always looking for book reviewers. Even commentaries. And we publish creative works too. Our society, we're lucky to have our own poet laureate, actually.
Yeah.
Howard Stein. Very awesome. He's a very sweet man, amazing poet. He always writes poetry for all the annual meetings, and we've published some of his stuff. And he's an applied anthropology poet. So shout out to Howard. I don't know if he's listening, but if he is. So we like to publish a range of things, and we like to include creative works too. But we focus on, our focus is applied anthropology and people looking at trying to work with communities to solve some sort of human issue that they're facing. Our society focused a lot on and contributed a lot to the anti oil pipeline work in the Dakotas last year. We raised money and sent funds and goods up to help the water protectors when they were faced with, the private security firms and the water cannons. So, I mean, we try to carry on in a way Omer's mission of being engaged and active in the communities and carry on, like, here we are in this position in academia to, use that knowledge for something that we feel is a worthy cause that we deem that's important. So we like to publish articles that reflect, reflect the original mission of the society, which is, we have this position let's go and try to inform the masses from what we've learned. And we want to include authors from the communities we work with. We encourage Indigenous authors to apply. We encourage, you know, scholars of all levels, undergraduate, grad student, you know, working professionals, everybody. So this, our first issue under My Leadership comes out in April. And you know, if people out there listening to your podcast are interested, I hope they submit, you know, and give us a consideration. So just a
shameless plug. I've obviously, you know, Kathleen, gone to a good number of the High Plains conferences and the retreat at Ghost Ranch. And it really is a great organization, especially for younger scholars, for students. It's a really low key. It's a lot like the Pecos conference for archaeology. Especially the Ghost Ranch retreat, where you can camp and, or you can stay at Ghost Ranch. But it's just, it's a really, not scary, I guess we'll say, way.
It's a good way to interact with people from other schools and other professors and other students, you know, who are in the same field as you with similar interests or different interests. And you make connections and you network in a very non-threatening environment. It's it's really great. And I'm not just saying that because I'm the past president, but I'm saying that as somebody who's participated in Ghost Ranch and the society for a number of years at all levels. So.
All right. So David, do you want to round us out with ASU's American Indian Studies program?
Of course. American Indian Studies here at ASU offers 2 degrees, a bachelor's and a master's, and we're focused primarily on law and policy. More specifically, we provide our students an education in the history of federal Indian law and policy, from the earliest treaties to more recent developments regarding Indian gaming, you know, or nation building. And we focus on the law and policy because most of the issues that tribal nations face, you know, stem from their legal status within the federal system. And so the kind of students that we try to recruit from all over, Indian and non-Indian, what we look for is an interest and dedication in trying to resolve these issues, whether it's with respect to, you know, environmental justice, with women's rights, with you know, language and cultural revitalization, you know, all of these concerns and the problems endemic to them, you know, all arise out of our historic relationship with the federal government. And so we attempt to provide our students the knowledge and the tools in order to make a meaningful contribution, you know, to the communities with whom they've developed a relationship, whether they were born in a given community, or whether, you know, through personal experience, they developed, you know, these relations. And so ultimately, you know, we want to be a part of the ongoing effort, you know, at enhancing tribal rights in America, you know, at developing, you know, our status as sovereign nations, and creating a brain trust, if you will, with our graduates, that the Native communities can rely upon, you know, as they establish an agenda, you know, for their future, whether it's economic ambitions, you know, political objectives, you know, or environmental or cultural interests. And so that's what we offer here. And so if you know any young people out there who are considering, especially a graduate program, you know, then by all means, send them our way. We'd be happy to talk to them.
Yeah, and I imagine that you probably have students that would be good for internships and things like that, if anybody wants to send a...
Indeed. We send them internships all the time.
Exactly. Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much all for coming on the show. And there's going to be lots and lots of goodies in the show notes. So everybody check out everything that's on the show notes.
Thank you, Jessica. It's fun to hear from other, from all of you, the good group you put together. Thank you.
Yep, I agree.
Thank you, Jessica.
Hi, this is Jessica cutting in again real quick. Just wanted to let you guys know a couple things. First of all, obviously, Lyle didn't end up being able to make it onto the recording. We were having some technical difficulties. So he and I actually recorded a follow-up bonus episode to this episode, just more talking about updates on what we've been up to and one big project we've been up to. So that should be coming out in the next couple weeks. So please keep an eye out for that, and I hope you guys will enjoy. And then also, obviously, this episode was recorded several months ago, actually. So there's a couple times in there you might notice references to things coming up in April, for example, which are obviously not coming up anymore. So just keep that in mind when listening to this episode. And on other time-related notes, Sean Gant from episode 13. He and I will be doing a webinar for the American Cultural Resources Association, Ethnography Basics, and it's on the role of ethnography in CRM, as well as basic ethics and methods for CRM ethnographic projects. Coming up here July 26th, 2018. So if you haven't registered for that yet, go to acra-crm.org and register for that. And I think that might be all for the announcements for today. So thank you again for listening, and I'll see you in a couple weeks for the bonus episode, or maybe sooner at the ACRA webinar. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.